Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, at long last, Rick Springfield's performance in Hard to Hold gets the credit it's always deserved. We'll count down our top five performances by musicians turned actors.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music from the Scotland Yard Gospel Choir, and, as an added bonus, your intrepid host, a one Adam Kempinar, sits down with none other than the Darjeeling duo, Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman.
We'll also hear from new Film Spotting contributor Carrie Shepherd with her take on one of the best films of the year so far. But first, Joaquin Phoenix and Funky Bunch band leader Mark Wahlberg take back the night.
You had to hit that spot.
Of all the places, you got to come to my place.
That's where the drug deal has been seen.
Nice friends you got there.
No, Poppy's not my friend.
What are we supposed to do, compromise the whole thing?
What, you want me to come into your place?
Hey,
listen?
Sooner
or later, either you're going to be with us, or you're going to be with the dealers. This is like a war out there.
Maddie, a couple shows ago, we shared our top five movies about brothers. Confident that you were overlooking something obvious, you were in search of a film with brothers on opposite sides of the law. And for your sins, Hollywood has given you one. The brothers in James Gray's We Own the Night are Mark Wahlberg's Joe, a police captain and the dutiful son of NYPD Chief Bert, played by Robert Duvall, and Joaquin Phoenix's prodigal son, Bobby, a Brooklyn nightclub manager who gets roped into the family business when a ruthless Russian mobster targets his brother and father. I use the phrase family business intentionally, of course, because I couldn't help but see Bobby in many ways as the anti-Michael Corleone, struggling with a similar existential crisis in the face of his father's peril and deciding, I'm with you now, Pop. Only here, our hero goes from the wrong side of the law to the right. Maddie, in addition to dealing with some of the same moral and philosophical quandaries as The Godfather, We Own the Night is similar in style and content to other 70s and early 80s classics. I'm thinking here of gritty police dramas such as Serpico and Prince of the City, both from Sidney Lumet. You are a big fan of both of those films. Were you a fan of We Own the Night?
Well, you know, you actually did read my mind. I mean, you can tell that director James Gray here has an affection for the genre he's delving into. I mean, this movie has a very 80s film feel about it. I mean, it's even set in 1988 in New York. And yeah, it's true. I love those types of films. And I was really, really with this film at the beginning. Gray does exactly what he needs to do at the outset. There are rules if you're attempting this kind of genre. And if you're going to be making a formulaic, melodramatic cop drama, one brother on one side of the law, the other running with the wrong crowd, the dad, of course, has to be the chief of police. You just have to jump in feet first, no questions asked. Don't let the audience even think a moment about suspending their disbelief. And this movie does that. I mean, it plunges you in to this world and really sets itself up well. Characters are introduced rapidly. I think the acting is really solid. We pick up what everybody is looking for. It doesn't matter that Phoenix, Duvall, and Wahlberg cannot possibly be related. We'll buy it. It's fine. And it moves really, really quickly. And it seems like every 3 minutes, the stakes just getting raised on top of stakes. Unfortunately, the second that you slow down and you let the audience begin to think about what's going on, they're going to be like, you're actually asking me to believe that happened? And that's what happens here. This movie just can't sustain itself. In the second half of the film, you become more aware of the faults you were willing to glaze over in the first half, the obvious and hammy dialogue. And the situations become not only implausible, but really sort of ridiculous. And around the time that Joaquin Phoenix gets deputized by the New York Police Department, I had really tuned out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we saw this film pretty much the same way with one big exception, and that is the acting, which we'll get into here in a second. But you're right. At some point, the movie does start asking you to accept things and makes you try to answer certain questions that you really just don't want to answer, at least with this kind of film.
Right.
But I do like how Gray isn't out necessarily to reinvent the cop drama here. I don't mind seeing a movie that hits every familiar note, some of which are just script things, like the trusted friend whose betrayal is revealed through a little slip
of
the tongue
we've
seen a million times. And of course, there is a great car chase, like you would expect in a cop drama like this, in the rain, but it is a little bit different, a little bit unconventional, where it's really eerie and underplayed, and it plays more like a nightmare, where everything just keeps getting worse and worse rather than an action-packed scene. I think it's meant to be more scary than titillating, and it absolutely is. And one of the reasons why it works is that Joaquin Phoenix, throughout this film, isn't Super Cop. He isn't Serpico. He isn't Bullet. He's a civilian who is panicked and scared and drives the way we would drive in that situation. And I like that element. I had to constantly alter my expectations because we've seen these scenes so many times before, but with people who know how to act under pressure, who know how to keep themselves together. But Bobby isn't a hero.
Right.
He's a nightclub owner in way over his head. So I liked all that. But what I didn't like is that a lot of times with material like this, like you said, pretty much formulaic, Gray really isn't trying to reinvent anything, as we said, but performances with material like this can either elevate it or degrade it.
Yeah.
And much of what is good about We Own the Night, I think, is undercut by an average performance by Mark Wahlberg and what I would consider an annoying performance by Phoenix, who unfortunately has to carry most of the movie. You want to talk about method acting gone wrong, Maddie. I think Joaquin Phoenix is exhibit A in this film.
No, actually, I'm going to disagree with you on this. I actually really liked Joaquin Phoenix, and I'm not a huge Joaquin Phoenix fan. In
That's
fact,
shocking.
I usually don't pronounce his name right. And yeah, there are times when he just sort of looks at the camera and it's like he's smelling the cheese, you know, and he's like looking very intense and his eyes almost go crosswire. That doesn't work for me in Gladiator. I thought he was okay in Walk the Line. Here, I think it's fine. I think he's actually playing to the material. I did have a problem with Wahlberg because I have a problem with Wahlberg when he plays at something, when he plays at being the cop, when he plays at being the spaceman who crash lands on Planet of the Apes. But I think Phoenix is absolutely fine here. I mean, it's really hard. It's a hard role to play because he's not really the bad seed.
No.
I mean, he's more of a black sheep.
Correct.
You know, he's not actually into doing anything illegal. And I think he pulls it off.
Okay, but what is it about your boy Mamet? What does Mamet say about acting in True and False, which I know you mostly subscribe to, and I know we can all criticize Mamet for some of the rigid performances we've seen in his films, but what does he say? Stand up straight and say your lines.
Yes.
And here, Phoenix would absolutely drive Mamet nuts. Almost every line, he either mumbles or says it under his breath while he stares at the floor.
Now, and you're right there, because that happens in the middle of the film,
to be
fair, and that's when I start to lose interest. So you are right there. I'll concede that.
In his element, I understand what he's going for. When he's in his element, when he's at the club and he's the manager, he's kind of the big guy on campus, he speaks louder, he looks people in the eye. But when he's with his family and with the police, he has no confidence or presence at all. And I get that. But there really is no drama in watching someone mope and internalize everything. And just to prove that I'm not crazy, and obviously you saw the same thing, I'm going to read a quick quote here from someone who saw it exactly the same way you did in terms of playing to the material. I happened to catch the blurb review of We Own the Night here in Time Out Chicago, Hank Sarton, the critic there. And he says, Phoenix's tendency to under-enunciate actually works with this character, who's pretty sloppy and vague about everything from family relationships to his consonants. And
well said. This is the first time that this has worked for me.
Except, though, and it is true with his consonants, sometimes I swear he just leaves out parts of words here. That's how much he is mumbling and talking under his breath. But vague and sloppy, those are not actable actions, as Mamet will tell you, as John Badham will tell you. I can't believe I'm playing the acting teacher, Maddie, here in this case. But they're absolutely right. You cannot act sloppy and vague. The character is either sloppy and vague, is either written that way, or the character isn't. And yet he's trying to do it throughout. He's trying to do too much to bring the subtext up to the textual level. And I think Wahlberg is guilty of some of the same things. And you touched on this. He's overacting by underacting. There's a great line in this film where he says to his brother, to Bobby, that he was always kind of jealous of him because he had the guts to do his own thing, to disobey his dad, whereas he always did what he was told. I think this is kind of obvious to anyone who was paying attention, but I really liked it. The problem is that Wahlberg seems intent on bringing that subtext, the weight of his character, to every single scene he's in.
I don't think Wahlberg knows how to delve into subtext. I can't believe we're getting off on this track because the acting is not what's going to annoy people here. Really,
it derailed the film for me. Watching Joaquin Phoenix stumble and mumble his way through this film completely took the movie from one I'd recommend to one I can maybe say it's worth renting.
Wow, I'm not that passionate about these performances at all. In fact, one of the things that I really liked was that they cast Bobby Duvall. Mm-hmm. When you cast Bobby Duvall in something, you don't need to waste time as a screenwriter and director coming up with an exposition for the chief of police. You can just cast Bob Duvall, and all of a sudden, there's the chief of police.
Right.
And to some extent, I think the other characters there can get away with that as well. And my problem is Wahlberg sees that. He says, okay, I need to be the cop. I need to be the family man. And so he plays at that idea.
Yeah.
And that actually unnerved me more than Joaquin Phoenix. You are bringing up every single problem I have had with Joaquin Phoenix's performance up until this film.
Really?
And this film, for the better half of the first part, was a lot of fun. And I thought he just kind of played right into it. It's just kind of, you know, a sleazy cop drama in the 80s. And I was willing to go along with it. He kind of fit in there as this sort of cartoonish figure in a pickle.
I too cared about his character, and I did see, as I said, those human elements in him, that he isn't this kind of superhero, and so I was caught up in the story a little bit. But
why
the fact
are we spending so much time on Joaquin Phoenix when we are ignoring Eva Mendes? Oh, how gorgeous and how talented for a really thankless role here as the girlfriend to Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, I think she is good here. I think there are a lot of good supporting roles, including Robert Duvall, and I think it's interesting how you mentioned that you don't really need a lot of exposition,
no.
And you're right, and normally I would actually praise any writer-director who doesn't waste a lot of time with exposition, but here this was a case where I did kind of feel like I didn't know that brother dynamic well enough, and maybe it was because of the performances, because I wasn't buying into them, but I actually felt like I didn't know enough about their dynamic, their relationship together, their relationship to their father. Again, maybe it was just this kind of standard formulaic thing, and Gray said, you know, we've all seen this a million times.
Yeah.
You know how they feel about each other. One's the black sheep. One does everything
exactly.
His father wants.
And you
but
know what?
I didn't buy into it enough.
I think what's funny, usually, you know, in films like this, there's one shot where the camera will pan over the mantle at home,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see these pictures, you know, taken. Obviously, I want to imagine, like, Robert Duvall and Mark Wahlberg and Joaquin Phoenix going down to the local Sears and sitting, you know, in front
sure.
of one of these backdrops. They don't even bother with that here.
No.
And I think that's fine. I think that's kind of fun. It's kind of a throwback to, like, the, you know, even those 50s gangster films where you get three stars and you say, here we go. This guy's bad. This guy's good. This guy's in a pickle. What happens next?
Okay. Well, the actor on the show liked the performances here and liked the movie. The non-actor, who obviously doesn't know what he's talking about,
exactly,
thought Joaquin
exactly.
Phoenix ruined this movie to a large extent. Well, We Own the Night is in theaters now. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail. Last week, Maddie, on the show, we discussed the Chicago International Film Festival, and we turned now to Carrie Shepherd for some thoughts on one of the movies we were most anticipating at this year's fest, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
I was nudged by Adam to attend this instead of The Man from London, and left with many ideas on how the film worked in every way. Reading the synopsis, I was tempted to stubbornly avoid it because anything that combines director Julian Schnabel and French Elle magazine screams pretentious. Instead, The Diving Bell is heartbreaking and moving, and impossible to sit through without shedding a tear, or several. Although I like Schnabel's previous works, I sometimes think he's more concerned with creating films as moving images of his paintings and less concerned with story. Fortunately, he inserted art and classic representations of beauty at every appropriate turn. The film is set mostly in a depressingly distant hospital where Jean-Dominique Bauby, or Jean Doe, the French editor of Elle magazine, is recovering from a paralyzing stroke. The once dashing, cool, and urbane journalist is suffering from what is known as locked-up syndrome, and director Schnabel lets you know right away what the character is experiencing. The first 15 minutes feature a claustrophobic angle from the vantage of Jean Doe. Luckily for my eyes, sanity, and the film, he pans out and instead focuses on trying to insert some beauty into the depressing setting that is Jean Doe's new reality. The strongest point of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly is how the director presents the main character's story as less of a fight for survival and more of a struggling tale of how tragedy strikes and oftentimes doesn't go away. Schnabel presents the true portrayal of a once hip, rich, religionless, bad father who never gets the chance to right his wrongs. He presents an honest story of someone who succeeds at almost every turn, but forgets about some of the important tasks that make us human. As I was growing more attached to the deteriorating man in the wheelchair, I was simultaneously liking Jean-Dominique Bauby, the editor and playboy, and seeing why he was so charismatic and successful. Not to be flip, but the sensational feat of writing his memoir by blinking one eye is somewhat secondary to the tales that the memoir tells. And it shouldn't go unnoticed that the supporting cast of beautiful, patient French women who bring the memoir to fruition are less distracting as pretty faces and more important and impressive as our only hope that Jean Doe will get a fair shot in his final days. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly will have wider theatrical release and deserves a nomination for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. If not, Khan, Toronto, and Adam and I will be wrong, and I will have to boycott watching the Oscars.
Thank you, Carrie, for that. I just want to add that I agree with her take completely. Maddie, you were unfortunately not able to make the screening last weekend, but I was equally awed by Diving Bell and can honestly say right now that it's one of my top five movies of the year so far, if not my favorite film. So you'll definitely be hearing more about it in the coming months. You can also hear more from Carrie with an equally cogent analysis, I think, of Denis Arcand's film The Age of Ignorance by visiting filmspotting.net.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, Adam sits down with Jason Schwartzman and Wes Anderson for what I'm sure will prove to be a very quirky conversation.
We'll see.
Stay with us. I used to buy drugs down at Aspidy Shore. I used to buy drugs. I knew all the police by first name. How are the wife and kids? I'm just hanging out. No need to rub me in. I left my mom's house with the feeling something needed doing, and I was just the one to do it. Well, it was always my fault. And if something went right, then I was never involved.
Is that my belt? Can I borrow it? Well, no, not right now. I was looking for that earlier. Ask first. Next time.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to Film Spotting. That was a scene from Darjeeling Limited, which Adam and I actually got a chance to review last week here on Film Spotting. And I have to say, both of us pretty much underwhelmed, gave it pretty lukewarm reviews. Now, you got a chance to sit down with this pair this week. I want to know, are we going to make their Christmas card list?
We might. We just might. I kept it pretty civil, of course, as you would expect, interviewing any subject on the show, but especially guys who I do respect and admire, despite the fact that this film we were a little bit mixed on. But I did ask them about some of those scenes that I had trouble with and that you also had trouble with. And I also mainly kept it to a discussion of the things that we both really liked about the film, including the way it looked. So you'll hear some discussion on that. But I actually started the conversation by asking Anderson about working a new member into his familiar troupe of actors, in this case, Oscar winner Adrian Brody.
Yes. Well, I like to work with my friends, so I often work with people I've worked with before. But with this movie, I was writing with two friends, Jason Schwartzman, who's here with us, and Roman Coppola, Jason's cousin, who's also my friend. And we wrote one of the parts for Adrian Brody, who we didn't know. But I just admired him in movies and wanted a chance to work with him, and I thought that he might be a great brother for this film that we were about to set off to do in India.
Jason, for you then, bringing him into the fold, how did that work?
Adrian folded in perfectly. He's very sensitive and an amazingly friendly, sweet person who came to India and within a matter of minutes was part of the whole thing. I mean, he's a guy who knows how to figure out a crowd and what it's going to take to become friends with everybody in that room. That sounds a little shady. But does it make sense? Like he just comes in, he gets to know everybody pretty quickly. I didn't find him to be standoffish or anything. But it's not like he's walking into the roughest crowd in the world. We're all pretty nice ourselves, so we welcomed him. Our arms were open, and he ran to them.
Well, he's really great here. I've read a couple of places how, Wes, for you, this movie started with that opening scene. You had this in your mind, but before it was even a movie, you just knew you wanted to collaborate with Roman and with Jason. Is this typical for you, or do you usually have more of the film mapped out and the scenes mapped out?
No, I think when I start working on a script, I usually have certain kind of, I usually have a few ideas, like a collection of ideas, but they could be any ideas. It could be collaborators, or it could be a few scenes, or it could be a kind of concept of the story, or just a setting even. So this one, that's what I had: India, three brothers on a train and the desire to make a movie about the dynamics that happen in families and the power struggles that can happen, particularly when families travel together, to learn about India and then also to work with Jason and Roman as writers.
Jason, as a writer then, when you get that first scene and read it, what happens next?
That when Wes first approached me about making the movie, he said, I want us to write a script together that's extremely personal, and I want it to be too personal even. And that was our kind of MO while we were writing the material, was always to make this a script based on things that had happened to us in our own lives or to people very close to us. So the film is a collage of experiences that we've all gone through. And the writing process really is trying to find out what parts of our real lives fit into this thing that we're trying to tell, the story that we're trying to tell, and how it can it became the thing we were trying to tell.
Let's go to Hotel Chevalier. I'm curious about that piece. When did you decide on that as kind of a prequel to the film?
Yes. Well, after, you know, we had the opening scene of the feature film, and then I wrote this short, a scene for Jason's character, and we had the idea that maybe he and Natalie Portman could play this scene together. And it was its own self-contained scene, but as we continued to write the movie, these two became more and more linked. So it's a very odd thing. There's a short film, like a short story, and then there's a little kind of novel, or maybe it's a novella, whatever the feature is. And they go together, but they also can be seen separately. The short is now on iTunes. And, you know, my hope is that people who see the short might want to see the movie, or people who see the movie will go and see the short, because they interact with each other, those two.
Your use of color in both pieces, I think, is really striking. Can you talk about how you developed that scheme, working with your cinematographer, how you collaborate with them, your designers?
Well, really, for this movie, it's very simple. We went to India, and we saw things we'd never seen before. We were tourists, and the place made a huge impression on me, and I wanted to share it, my experience. So really, everything that you see in the movie is just our discoveries and the surprises that we experienced traveling in this incredibly complex and incredibly rich in its ways. I mean, it's rich in culture. There are many cultures. There are many languages. There are many religions, and so much religion. I mean, more ritual practiced there than anywhere else I've ever been. I became fascinated with this place, which I think is a common reaction of you know, foreigners who go there, that people fall in love with it.
Beyond the use of color, I think it's also maybe your most ambitious film just visually in terms of camera movement. The camera is moving a lot just as these characters are on board this train. So I guess I'm wondering, do you think that's accurate, and was that an intent of yours to be more ambitious?
I felt like there's a lot to look at there. So probably it's shot in a way that reflects that there's a lot going on. And you know, they're on a moving train. We shot on a train. I don't know if that's, I'm not sure if we might be the first ones to do that. Shoot this much of a movie on a real train, which was complicated, but not frustrating. You know, it was exciting. And so I think we got to see more of India that way. And yeah.
Jason, there's a pretty big tonal shift, I think, about in the middle of this film when the guys get off the train,
yeah,
where a tragic event happens and they're involved in something that, from a grief point of view, I don't know that I've seen in other Wes Anderson films.
Yeah.
How did you guys handle that and approach those scenes, those sequences, when you were writing?
Well, when we first started writing the movie, we knew we were going to have this scene happen. We just didn't know the specifics of it. How do we handle it? Well, we just knew that it was going to be the scene that would knock them off their laminated adventure.
Was there any fear that the audience watching a movie with these characters, kind of absurdist,
yeah,
comedy, deadpan style,
yeah,
all of a sudden dealing with some heavy stuff, some real grief, how the audience would react to that?
No, I think that hopefully the audience wants to see this happen to the characters.
I don't know if they want to see it. But we don't really approach it from what the audience wants to see.
Right.
You know, that was the concept of our movie, is that the first part of the movie, these brothers they're quite self-absorbed. They're visiting this country that they claim to want to learn about, but they aren't making any effort to do so, and they're thrown off this train. But at a certain point, things more important than their experience happen around them. They witness something that has not, that is completely outside their world, and it brings them to a halt.
I feel like so far on our show this year, reviewing movies every week, there's been about 10 times just this year alone where we've commented on how we feel like other directors are ripping off your style. Do you see that, and how do you react to it when you watch other films?
Just out of curiosity.
I knew you were going to ask me that. I'll mention one film in particular that I know recently came up, the film Rocket Science that played at Sundance felt a lot like a Wes Anderson film to me, but I know it's come up at least five or six times this year that we feel like other directors are really kind of mimicking you. Do you recognize that as well?
No, but I want to see this Rocket Science. I think anytime that does happen, I would be flattered and pleased by that. But I don't. Then I have a feeling if I saw it, I'd say, "Well, this guy seems to be doing his own thing." That's probably what I would see.
Jason, what about you? Do you recognize it at all in other films that you see?
No, I think everyone just is doing their own thing, kind of. And sometimes you see influences of people and all their work, but I haven't seen a movie where I said, "Oh my God, that guy's ripping off Wes."
Wes, I had a friend who's a film student ask me to ask you this question, and he does not mean it in any kind of derogatory way, but he was curious whether or not you would ever work in a genre other than Wes Anderson. Do you have any interest in making what would be a genre film as opposed to maybe your personal kind of style?
Well, Jason and Roman and I had a genre movie we talked about doing together, but I don't really see when you say in my style, but I don't really see my style. I mean, I can see I have ways I like to do it, but I'm not so much conscious of that. Like when Jason and Roman and I were writing our script together, it was the three of our points of view combined, and we just did what we wanted for that. And then maybe the way I end up directing it is going to be, I mean, I don't want to try to avoid things that resemble my other work. I want to just do what I feel is best for the story and you know, I just want to stay true to myself. So then that maybe ends up, you know, becoming seeming like a sort of style, or you can tell who made it. But I wouldn't even know. I don't want to be too conscious about it, I suppose.
I'm sure I'm not alone in that every time I see one of your films, I walk away having discovered a song I wasn't familiar with, usually by a band that I already liked. With Tenenbaums, it was She Smiled Sweetly, the Rolling Stones. Here, it's that song we get in the opening scene, This Time Tomorrow, by the Kinks, which I had never heard before and now can't get out of my head. Can you talk about how you decide to feature music? Was that song, for example, one that maybe you had in mind all along?
Yes, that was a song that I had set aside a long time ago and wanted to use, and have wanted to use in a movie for quite a long time, This Time Tomorrow. So, yeah, it was a chance to. And then as it happened, it worked out that I could use three different songs from that same album at these three key points in the movie, in the story.
Bill Murray, I wanted to ask you about real quick. He's become obviously part of this ensemble. Was he someone you always had in mind, someone you wanted to work with consistently, or did that really come out of casting him in Rushmore?
Well, I wanted to cast him. I was a great fan of his, and then I got the chance to work with him when we did Rushmore, and so then from then on, I often would, you know, I wanted to. Even once we finished Rushmore, I had a thought that I'd like to do the movie that became The Life Aquatic, and when we were doing the Royal Tenenbaums, we were even talking about that role. If you have a chance to cast Bill Murray in one of the parts, then you just do it.
Jason, what's next for you?
I have a film coming out called The Mark Pease Experience with Ben Stiller. It's about a cappella vocal singing groups and their struggle to survive in the modern day world. And also I made an album under the band name Coconut Records, which is available on iTunes and also at youngbabyrecords.com.
I've heard good things about it from friends. Wes, what about you? Do you have something in the works then?
Yes, it's a Coconut Records. It's a very good album, I will say. It's quite varied. Like, there's songs in different genres, many different genres, I would say, and it's really beautiful. I mean, my personal favorite, Summer Day?
Summer Day.
I think that's a good one.
Look forward to it.
It's a duet. And I'm working on something called Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is an adaptation of a Roald Dahl story by that Noah Baumbach and I made the script for, and George Clooney plays Mr. Fox, and we just started working on it in England.
This time tomorrow.
There's really a great dynamic between those two buddies, Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman, that I do think came through a bit there in the interview. But it is funny, maybe to no one's surprise, Wes Anderson really does direct everything, even this interview. He directed it in large part, where he would interrupt Schwartzman at some points and say, hey, maybe you could go this way with your answer, or what about this? Do you remember this? And it was kind of funny, but it was the kind of thing where it was never obnoxious at all. You can tell they're friends, mm-hmm. and they can get away with that kind of thing. So there is some more bonus audio as well at filmspotting.net. You'll hear Anderson and Schwartzman answer a couple of our listener questions.
Very cool. All right, well, time for another quick break. When we return, how could you do an entire show about Chicago movies and not include Chicago? Are you joking? Am I on candid camera? Your feedback and Massacre Theater up next. Stay with us.
These last few days I've been on pins and needles. Wet, sweaty palms, sick to my stomach. I know what I said. I know what I wish I'd said. I know I never said enough. I never thought today would come so quickly.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, Maddie. And there are three classic movies coming out here to really get the film buff truly excited this week. We'll start with the Criterion Collection edition of Breathless. It's a special edition, a double disc set, includes a new transfer, new video interviews with D.A. Pennebaker and also Raoul Coutard, who was Godard's cinematographer. A lot to check out there on that one. And also the one I'm probably the most excited about, the Criterion edition of Days of Heaven, the Terrence Malick film. That one has an audio commentary by many of the people who worked on the film and video interviews with Haskell Wexler, the great cinematographer, director of Medium Cool, which we talked about last week on the show. And lastly, another one to be excited about, a movie we reviewed here as part of our Silent Films Marathon, Battleship Potemkin from Sergei Eisenstein. This is an all-new HD transferred restoration of the film. It includes dozens of missing shots that have been replaced and all 146 title cards restored to Eisenstein specifications. So if you happen to catch that film as part of our marathon or were a fan of it before, or if you haven't seen it, you really need to check out Battleship Potemkin. Also out quickly, Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures. This is another set of his films, which, as I recall, the last time they were released really didn't have any extra features on them. I think there is some more stuff to sink your teeth into this time. And then the director's cut of Hostel and Hostel Part 2, Eli Roth, including Eli Roth commentary and a second commentary and even a third commentary on Hostel 2 if you are a fan of the torture porn genre, which I know, Maddie, I'm not. You do like the movie Saw, though.
I appreciate Saw. I have to admit, I haven't seen Hostel, but I'm really looking forward to this director's cut because it has the shocking original ending deemed too disturbing for theatrical audiences.
There you go.
Looking forward to that.
That is good advertising there. Who wouldn't want to check that out? Maddie, let's thank people who were so generous this week. They went to filmspotting.net, clicked on the donations link, and generously sent some of their hard-earned money to support the show.
Exactly. Now, you don't actually get your Sam Van Halgren nickname.
Not this week.
This week. But, you know, Adam, we are broadcast here locally on WBEZ.
Yes.
And they were having their pledge drive this week. And I was thinking, now, when people send in to the Film Spotting coffers, right, and we appreciate any and everything, why don't we take a page from them? I mean, in addition to their Sam Van Halgren nickname, where's the Film Spotting tote? Or the Film Spotting Live at Red Rocks DVD.
The nickname isn't enough?
No, we should. We got to look into this merchandise.
You're saying we need some merch?
Exactly.
You're absolutely right.
You know, something that they can tote around.
I know our listeners have been on us about that for years, and hopefully someday we will get to that point where we will have some nice merchandise to send out. But right now, alas, we do not. And it is my fault. I'll admit to that. I did this week forget to email Sam and ask for your nicknames. You will get them next week on the show, but we still want to thank you this week.
Yeah, thank you to Ben and Mark and Silver Club member Paul. A reminder, you will be getting your nicknames, we promise, next week. If you would like to donate, go to filmspotting.net. There is a discreet little donations link on the right side of the page. Again, any and all donations are welcome.
But now here you are, you're talking at me. I knew that there were
Why aren't you popular with Chicago Police Department?
Something that really doesn't concern you.
She hurt you, Janet?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry you're hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I didn't say I was hurt. You said I was hurt.
I asked you if you were hurt, and you said, yeah, I'm hurt.
That's because you made me say. You're starting to put words in my mouth.
Jack, you're a grown man. You have control over your own words.
You're goddamn right I do. So here come two words for you. Shut the fuck up.
Welcome back, everybody, to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the time where Adam and I massacre a film we love, and you, the listener, get a shot at a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred one of my all-time favorite films, Midnight Run, a tie-in, of course, with our top five Chicago movies.
Correct, though some listeners did feel the need to point out that it isn't really a Chicago movie. I don't believe any parts of it take place here. But why are you unpopular with the Chicago Police Department? One of the all-time great lines. And, of course, his backstory there, De Niro's backstory, a lot of it takes place in Chicago.
Exactly.
So we wanted to include it.
And there is a good shootout that takes place, actually, at Lake and Wabash downtown when they're changing the buses.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, it's been a while since I've seen it. Also, Maddie, I did want to quickly note that some listeners, some thanked me for not trying a De Niro impression. Some were upset that I didn't bother with the De Niro impression. What's really sad is that was my De Niro impression. That's the best I could do.
Adam, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Stephen Youngkin from Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Congratulations, Stephen. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, I'm not going to provide any hint at all.
This is a good one.
It will be painfully obvious.
This is a really good one.
What the connection is. Just think about what we're discussing here on this week's show. Maddie, I started off. You give me the action.
And action.
Cool. You ever go to Vince's out here? Oh, no, you couldn't. I would have seen you. I'm there every day.
I've always wanted to work out at Vince's.
Yeah, here we go. Taste that.
Rock and roll.
Right. Thanks. Hey, did you ever see that movie Star Wars?
Like 4 times.
People tell me I look like Han Solo.
Really? Huh.
What do you bench?
You tell me first.
I asked you first.
Same time.
Cool.
Ready?
Ready.
One, two, three. You didn't say anything.
Neither did you.
And scene.
Now, if you know what film Adam and I just massacred, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. That's feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, October 24th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hello, Film Spotting. This is John Callender calling you from my commute through beautiful downtown Malibu. I'm late on this, but I wanted to mention I was listening to the feedback about movies about brothers, and I realized you did not mention Rumblefish, which I think is a great movie about brothers.
Hey, Adam and Maddie. This is Mark calling from Dallas. Just wanted to chime in a few thoughts on Michael Clayton, which I saw at the One Theater it was playing here this weekend. I think you described it absolutely perfectly. I think it is a very good airport thriller. It kind of reminded me of an above-average John Grisham movie, I think, but I think Clooney is solid in it. He's solid at picking scripts, and I think he's a solid actor, and I think over half of our Film Spotting listeners agree. So, in any case, keep up the good work, guys, and look forward to hearing the show this weekend.
A couple of good voicemails there. John mentioning the Francis Coppola film Rumblefish is a good brothers movie from our top five a few weeks ago, and also Mark in Dallas mentioning Michael Clayton, echoing what you had to say, calling it a good airport thriller, Maddie. So Mark agrees with you, as did at least one other listener. We'll get into some Michael Clayton feedback as well as our Chicago movies feedback here in a moment. Last week on the show, we promised an interview with John Cusack, and instead we had an interview with Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman. I did actually do the John Cusack interview. We talked about Grace Is Gone. It was part of a roundtable discussion, that interview was. Unfortunately, I was not only playing host, I was playing producer, and I did a very poor job. Poor enough that the audio is not good enough to play on air, and actually we have provided a transcript of the interview that you can get over at spout.com. So if you want to read the John Cusack interview where he did answer a few of my questions about the film, you can get a direct link by visiting filmspotting.net. There will be a badge you can't miss in the top right rail of filmspotting.net to look for that if you're a John Cusack fan. And also, we said last week, Maddie, that we would have reviews this week of Gone Baby Gone and Rendition. We've decided to push those reviews to next week. So tune in next week for those discussions. And now we jump into the mailbag, Maddie, and we start with someone correcting me.
Yes, of course. I always like people that write in to correct you. Hey, Adam, Risky Business was directed by Paul Brickman. I'll admit, whoever that is. Not Mazursky, an important distinction.
I'm sure it's an important distinction maybe to Paul Mazursky, who doesn't want to be confused with Paul Brickman, who only made one other film. But certainly Roger there was not alone in mentioning that I did screw that up. And I have to admit, that was one of those things where I didn't have any notes on Risky Business. I was just talking off the top of my head. I had no intentions of mentioning Paul Brickman or who directed the film. I just knew it was someone named Paul. And all of a sudden, I felt the words coming out of my mouth. And I was like, well, Maddie didn't stop me. So
well, I wasn't
must be
listening,
right.
Obviously.
Of course not. Of course not. What else is new? But it is true. I screwed that up. My apologies to listeners, to Paul Brickman, and to Paul Mazursky. Risky Business was a Paul Brickman production. We get in now to the mailbag, Maddie, and we start with some thoughts on Michael Clayton from Corey Atad. Adam, you have no soul. Is it impossible for you to just sit and enjoy a movie? Granted, I wasn't exactly enamored with Michael Clayton until about halfway through, but I chalked that up to being half asleep for much of that time. Thankfully, this movie is so taut and exciting, it was able to wake me up like a glass of water to the face.
Yes.
George Clooney delivers another one of his solid performances, patent pending, but more than even George Clooney is the writing and directing at play here. The film is incredibly well-crafted. There is always enough information given to keep the viewer up with the plot while also adding some depth to otherwise one-note characters. By the end, with everything that has gone on, all that the audience hopes for is that the good guy shows the bad guy what's for, and this movie gives us that satisfaction. The director here doesn't choose to throw a needless twist to say screw you and insult our intelligence. He lets George Clooney kick some ass, albeit verbally, but really that's more than I could have hoped for. What I want to know is when your transformation into Adam Van Kempenaar will be complete. You're already pretty far along. That's our friend Corey in Toronto.
Well, I love it. I love it because I'm the one that gets accused of being so negative here. I love that the tables are turned a
That's
little bit.
That's true.
People are seeing the true face of Adam Kempenaar.
Including Rick here.
Of course. He says, hey guys, still loving the show, obviously, and still trying to learn what to take away from Maddie's reviews and his tastes. I was beginning to wonder if we shared tastes in common. And then I saw Michael Clayton last night. And Maddie, you were on the money. And now I think I know where you're coming from, what works for you and what doesn't, all that. It was fan-freaking-tastic. I've been reading reviews all morning just to kind of try and recapture the viewing experience. The almost Mehmedian dialogue, the unhurried yet brisk direction, the gorgeous photography, George Clooney's best performance. We had none of his looking cute for the camera and those twinkling eyes and cocky half-smiles that pretty much made him a movie star. And the moment with the horses in the beginning, I mean, I was just sucked in start to finish. I finally completely agree with a Maddie ballgame review. Best and thanks for the show, guys. That's Rick again in Los Angeles.
Rick Maragi, we do appreciate his feedback as always. I will say the stuff with the horses, I'm sorry, I wasn't buying a bit of it. And also, he'll have to convince me where the Mehmetian dialogue is in this film, because obviously based on our review of We Own the Night, I'm all things Mamet here.
Good
on
God,
film
we've
spotting.
Created a monster.
We have created a monster. This is what happens when you read books. You think you know more than you actually do.
So I try and avoid it all
I
costs.
Know. There you go. But obviously some support there, Maddie, for you on Michael Clayton. A movie, as I said, I did like. I just didn't get obviously sucked into it the way Rick did and the way Corey did, and I'm happy for them. Let's move on, though, Maddie, to some of our Chicago movies feedback, tying in with the Chicago Film Festival. We did our obvious top five Chicago movies, and then we did the more overlooked films. And Connor S. wants to know, are we freaking crazy? Are we insane? How could you do an entire show about Chicago movies and not include Chicago, the best movie musical ever made, and the definitive Chicago movie? You did not even mention it once. Are you joking? Am I on candid camera? Maddie, you actually have a very obvious answer to this question.
Well, I love Chicago. I think it's a beautiful musical and not a terrible film. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't filmed in Chicago.
No.
I think it was filmed in Toronto. Pretty famously, Chicago was snubbed here.
Are you sure you're not screwing up your Canadian regions here?
Oh, God, here we go again.
But you're right. It doesn't take place here in Chicago. Most of it takes place on a soundstage. And when I think of Chicago, the city, I don't think of any scenes from Chicago.
I think there's one shot of the Chicago Theater on State Street, and that's about it.
That might be about it.
Yeah.
So there is your answer, Connor. We're not joking, and you're not on candid camera. We get onto this top five list from Sean Lane here in Chicago. His number five, Road to Perdition. An unknown Daniel Craig made this film for me. I forgot that Daniel Craig plays the crazy cartoonish son to Paul Newman in that film. Number four, a tie, a sports tie. Brian Song and Eight Men Out. Is The Room Getting Dusty? The ultimate guy cry movie and a remarkable look at early 20th century baseball. I agree. I like both of those films, of course, but especially Eight Men Out. I'm a John Sayles fan.
Say It Ain't So, Joe.
Say It Ain't So. A John Cusack movie there, of course. I did consider that for my list. And number three, The Blues Brothers. I hate Illinois Nazis. Number two, The Untouchables and The Sting. Two looks at crime in the age of Capone, or was The Sting earlier? I can't remember. It's been forever since I've seen The Sting, but that's another one that came up a lot from listeners. Yeah. A classic film. He says, it's in his all-time top 10, so why isn't it number one on the list? Well, his number one is I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. As someone who has dabbled in the Chicago improv scene for the better part of a decade, I consider Jeff Garlin a god. Jeff Garlin, of course, from Curb Your Enthusiasm. He filled this movie with Chicagoan friends who do wonderful jobs in their roles, and as a big divorced guy with commitment issues, how could I not love this film? It's playing now at the Music Box. I think you guys should check it out if you haven't already. Maddie, you have checked it out.
I actually did, and this is a movie not without its charms. It's not a great film, but he hits it right on the head. He does get a lot of Chicago improvisers involved with this. Dave Pasquese, who's one of the best improvisers I've ever seen, has a nice part in this film. It's a solid date movie, and one of the things I did really like about it, having been a part of the Chicago theater scene for some years now, it really nails my story. And so of course it's fun to see the neighborhoods on screen where I hang out. But I think this is actually a really nice segue to our next email from Kamaria B. Porter. Hey guys, I was pleasantly surprised to hear your Chicago movies top five. I've seen Hoop Dreams and Raisin in the Sun, which captured things this city is built upon. Race, neighborhood, separation, and the fights and risks people take to overcome the obstacles of the city. I do have another overlooked Chicago movie, The Killing Floor. I watched this in my labor history class. It's about the slaughterhouses in the early 20th century. The race riots of 1919 are depicted, labor organizing across race and ethnic divides, and black migration. I actually don't think there are many good Chicago movies or Chicago directors that capture the history of the city or the tensions that define this culture. I grew up on the South Side, and I love High Fidelity, but when I watched it, it felt completely foreign. So I don't consider it a Chicago movie, just a good film that's filmed on the North Side and an L train. I think that's absolutely beautifully put, and it made me think of a lot of things. When I was at the Chicago Film Festival this year, I did notice a discouraging trend in American independent film, and that's the fact that it mirrors studio films in that it's absolutely, for the most part, Lily White. And I love how she says here that she loves High Fidelity. She can recognize it as a good film, but it's not her Chicago.
Right.
It could have been filmed in Milwaukee, and it doesn't speak to her experience at all. And Adam, I just want to say, do you know what the number one movie for the past weekend was? It wasn't Michael Clayton.
I do not know.
It was Tyler Perry's new movie, of which I don't even know the title. And I can't say I've even seen a Tyler Perry film.
No, I haven't either, though you did say it last week on the show.
Yeah.
Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get
Why
Married?
Why Did I Get Married?
I believe what it is. But that's interesting. I mean, it's not Kamari's experience, but it is closer to my experience, which you may imagine as a 30-year-old white guy who did spend some time living on the north side of Chicago. My experience would be more like that film than Kamaria would have, obviously. So some great points there in The Killing Floor, a film that sounds absolutely fascinating. I do love that kind of old-time Chicago history, and so some of those movies would be really fun to check out. I'll actually mention another kind of Chicago film when we get to our top five here in the next segment. To close, I do just want to mention Shane LaFever's email. He says he's a new listener and he loves the show, by the way, but he does notice that most Gen Xers, like himself, love a movie as a kid, and then as they get older and wiser and they go back and check them out, they don't hold up. And we've talked about this a little bit on Film Spotting over the past couple of years, and he thinks that Ferris Bueller's Day Off falls into that category.
No.
He may be right. I've said this before. Sometimes those movies don't stand up at all, but how could you ever judge them critically or objectively? They're so embedded in your youth, at least for me they are, that I can't watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off and really judge it from any kind of objective critical perspective. It is just one of those classic films that I loved as a kid. But his big complaint with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which we did have as our number one obvious Chicago movie, is that he doesn't think Matthew Broderick can pull off being the cool kid that everyone likes in school. I think he completely pulls that off.
About?
I don't know. Okay, well.
You know what I was thinking, though, Adam? I think we should start the Film Spotting Ferris Bueller Tour Bus Company.
You think so?
We'll take people around Chicago. We'll try and hit every single event as fast as he hit them.
Maybe so, and we'll never pull that off. We
no,
can be
of
like
course.
Vince Vaughn and Vincent D'Onofrio in The Breakup.
Well, another great Chicago
that's right.
movie.
We'll take Chicago by land, by sea, and by air eventually. As always, if you've got feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we come back, Adam plays Prince to my Morris Day, or perhaps Dolly Parton to my Dabney Coleman.
Keep dreaming.
Adam and I honor our favorite performances by musicians turned actors. Please stay with us.
I was far away from my Saccio,
and frescoes in the Brancacci Chapel. I was thinking about you, boy, ungodly thoughts, I know, but I'm not ashamed. I was dreaming I was filming a picture with you on an island there. Somewhere off the mainland, we were alone, we were getting some practice in.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Excuse me.
Oh.
Hi, I'm Tony Lacey.
Well, hi.
We just wanted to stop by and say that we really enjoyed your set.
Oh, yeah, really?
I thought it was very musical. I liked it a lot.
Oh, that's really nice. Gosh, thanks a lot.
Are you recording? Are you with any label now?
Me? No.
Oh, well, I'd like to talk to you about that sometime if you get a chance.
And
possibly working together.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. A clip there from the great Annie Hall, Woody Allen's film, of course. Alvy, Annie in that scene, and Paul Simon, of course, a musician turned actor. I think that may have been his first movie role, but I don't know for sure. And really, as you noted to me earlier today, Maddie, Paul Simon really can't act.
No, he can't act, but he's game for anything.
He is.
Actually, the second episode ever of Saturday Night Live is pretty much all Paul Simon.
That's true.
There's some great skits in there.
Yeah, there absolutely are. But we wanted to play that just as kind of an introduction, one that obviously won't make our top five, tying in with We Own the Night, Mark Wahlberg, a musician. I guess if you want to call Marky Mark a musician, turn actor. We'll get into that here in a minute. But first, we did want to share our poll results from last week. We asked you what you thought the best Chicago movie was, tying in with our top five list. And we gave you our top five no-brainer Chicago movie options. They were in alphabetical order: The Blues Brothers, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Fugitive, High Fidelity, and The Untouchables. And we gave you the option of choosing other if you didn't want to go that route. Maddie, how did it come out?
Pretty overwhelming victory. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, number one at 41%. The Blues Brothers, second at 24%. The Untouchables at 16%. High Fidelity, 11%. The Fugitive, this was a little bit of a surprise for me, only 4%. And Other, coming in, we must have done a good job on our choices.
Maybe so.
Only at 3%.
Yeah, and actually you say that, we must have done a good job because the list pretty much mirrors our top five.
Yeah.
They're in order except that our listeners had The Untouchables ahead of High Fidelity. We had The Untouchables fourth with High Fidelity third, but I'm certainly not surprised at all to see The Untouchables, more of maybe a classic film, up there a little bit higher. Which brings us to this week's poll question. The film American Gangster is coming out in a couple weeks with Russell Crowe, with Denzel Washington. Mm-hmm. As listeners may remember from our most anticipated fall movies, this was in our top five. I think Sam, actually, when we were debating our list, he had it as his number two.
Wow.
That's how confident he is that this movie is going to work and that Ridley Scott, the director, is going to deliver. And so tying in with that, we wanted to know what you think Ridley Scott's best film is. So, excluding Alien and Blade Runner,
those
the two
are
obvious
important points
heavies,
to make. There.
Yes. Ridley Scott's best film is?
Is it Black Hawk Down, Gladiator, Kingdom of Heaven, Matchstick Men, Thelma and Louise? I forgot he directed Thelma and Louise. Or Other, Come On, White Squall.
Maddie, where are you voting in this poll?
I am going to have to go with, my God, Thelma and Louise.
Really?
Yeah, I love that film.
You have such a feminine side, Maddie.
Thank you.
I think our listeners appreciate that.
I actually thought Penny Marshall directed that.
Ouch.
Ouch, I'm terrible.
No, someone who actually can direct made Thelma and Louise. Sorry, I know that cuts you. You look hurt right now, Maddie.
She directed Big. Jumpin' Jack Flash.
I know.
Renaissance Man.
One of the worst movies I've ever seen, Renaissance Man. But you're going with Thelma and Louise, a noble pick. This is a tough one for me. I would probably have to go with Gladiator. I'm sorry. I think it's a good film.
It's good
one of those rewatchable movies. But Black Hawk Down may be the better achievement. That's a movie I think is really strong, a really strong war
film. It's a really strong war film. Unfortunately for me, it's pretty much just a battle reenactment. I don't really get excited even about watching Gettysburg being reenacted.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate that it's really well made. It's not a movie that's going to draw me back to it repeatedly.
No, I agree, partly because the subject matter is obviously harrowing enough that who wants to live through a bunch of soldiers or civilians dying, but I think a really well-crafted film, and a film I liked a lot because it gives us a side of war that we don't usually see, which is the urban war.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a reason why I like it a lot. But let's get on to this week's top five list. As we said, ties in with We Own the Night, with Mark Wahlberg. There have been a lot of musicians over the years, singers, drummers, whatever, who have decided to make the move to the big screen. And so we thought it'd be fun to count down our list of our favorite performances, not the five best musicians turned actors, but performances by these people. I may cheat a little bit and throw in a couple extra performances. You'll probably do the same thing. Don't give me that look, Maddie. I'm sure you cheat a little bit. But I will note, some people may want to say, well, what about like J-Lo in Out of Sight? She's fantastic, and she is really good in Out of Sight, but she was an actor,
before
a musician. Yeah. So that doesn't count, at least for the purposes of this list. Maddie, what's your number five?
All right, my number five is Will Oldham from Old Joy. Will Oldham is actually better known as the cult rocker Bonnie Prince Billy, but absolutely shines in this, what I think is an entrancing film from director Kelly Reichardt, a movie that was easily on my top 10 for 2006. This film, it's an open book. It's really open for interpretation, like The Pit in Poe's Pit and the Pendulum. It is whatever you want to take from it. For me, it's a reflection on growing older and friendships as two longtime friends entering the middle stages of life take a weekend trip to some hot springs in Oregon, and Oldham plays the guy caught in the past, refusing to grow up, and he plays it with just this beautiful, subtle authenticity, and I really would encourage people to check this film out.
Yeah, I encourage it as well. We did debate this film a little bit. Yeah. You liked it more than I did, but I think subtle is an understatement in this film. You talk about open for interpretation. There is a lot there, and I do respect that a lot about that movie, and the performances, including Will Oldham, they're fantastic.
They're terrific.
So Old Joy is one to check out. A movie from last year that I will also note that we had a handful of listeners last year say, I really wish you had talked about this film. It's one of my favorite of the year. So you're not alone, Maddie. My number five, this may be a pick partly out of the fact that I love this musician and I love the band. And my pick is Levon Helm as Loretta Lynn's father in Coal Miner's Daughter. Of course, Levon Helm, the drummer for The Band, a group
good
I like a
pick.
Lot.
I would never have thought of that.
No, he's a grizzled coal miner in the film with a family of eight kids in Butcher Hollow, Kentucky. And you want to talk about authenticity and integrity. He brings it to everything he does. And two other performances I like from him, I'll just mention, also really small, but he plays Jack Ridley, a test pilot who's friends with Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff.
Oh.
And he's also the narrator in The Right Stuff. And he's a blind man out in the middle of nowhere. You may remember in The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, just a quick kind of 10-minute scene where they come across him that really does catch your attention. So I love Levon Helm, again, partly because I love him as a musician, but he's my number five.
Very good pick. All right, well, my number four, sit tight and listen keenly while I play for you another brand new musical biscuit from the Hilton's Empire. This is a brand new song they call The Harder They Fall by the man called Ivan. 1972, Jimmy Cliff in The Harder They Come. And there's some full disclosure here on my part. The morning after I saw this film, which was a midnight screening in college, I cannot account for my whereabouts between 3 and 9 a.m. And I think, luckily, no police reports can account for my whereabouts either. But, you know, the moral of the story is I think I had a pretty good time. But I do remember walking out of the theater and thinking, God, Jimmy Cliff can really act. And it's not a huge stretch. He plays Ivanhoe Martin, a Jamaica shantytown resident with hopes of becoming a reggae superstar. But instead, he turns to crime for a quick score. It's a low-budget cult hit. I think it gets lumped in with other blaxploitation films. But it has a Criterion DVD release. And the soundtrack, which I own, is absolutely killer. And I swear to God, Jimmy Cliff is really good.
I look forward to checking out his performance and that disc and the soundtrack. A great pick there. I'm going a little more conventional with my number four. Also an actor who happens to appear, it turns out, in The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada as a sheriff, not really interested in doing his job, and that's Dwight Yoakam.
Dwight Yoakam.
Yeah,
nice,
and I'm
nice
thinking
pick.
Of him for two roles here, the abusive father in Sling Blade, but also the quiet, crazy killer Raoul in David Fincher's Panic Room. He's such a down-home, good old country boy. I mean, doesn't Dwight Yoakam seem like the kind of guy you'd love to just hang out with and have a few beers with? And yet, in both of those roles, he's absolutely terrifying.
That's
so,
a good pick.
Dwight Yoakam's my number four.
All right, my number three. You want to talk about conventional? Well, here's mine, and it's Will Smith in Ali.
Nice.
I mean, this is based entirely on blowing away my expectations. I think it's an absolutely Herculean task, if damn near insane, to attempt to play Muhammad Ali. So I admit, when I heard Will Smith was going to play him, I was just incredulous and wanted nothing to do with the entire project. And in the end, I think there are a lot of nits I can pick with Michael Mann's film, but Will Smith's performance is not one of them. I thought he was fantastic. He did the impossible. He created his Muhammad Ali. It wasn't an impression.
Mm-hmm.
It was fleshed out and interpretive, and I think there's a reason that Will Smith is so commercially viable. He's a great foil for the audience. We like him. He's funny along the lines, you know, of Harrison Ford and Tom Hanks. And you know what I'd love for him to do? I'd love him to pull a Clooney and actually get behind some smaller projects that he's passionate about. I'd love to see what really stirs him in film.
Hmm. Beyond a film like The Pursuit of Happiness, something a little less mainstream.
Even less mainstream.
Okay, I think that's a great pick and a great idea for Will Smith as well. He is a fine actor. I like him a lot. I think he's even good in those comedic roles in like Men in Black, which is a film I like. But you're right, I think his performance in Ali is probably better than the film as a whole. I have some issues with Michael Mann's film as well, but a great choice. My number three, got to have Tom Waits on this list somewhere. Yeah. He's really memorable in an uncredited role as a disabled vet in the Fisher King, Terry Gilliam's film. But, of course, I'm thinking of him here in Jim Jarmusch's Down by Law. You could also single out John Lurie, of course, his co-star in that film, and another Jarmusch regular from The Lounge Lizards. He's in that movie, but that gravel voice of Waits plus his songs in that film are one of the biggest pleasures of Down by Law.
Now, I heard a rumor. I want our listeners to write in if they know the answer to this. Is it true that to get his voice that way, Tom Waits spent hours screaming into a pillow?
Might be one of those
urban legends.
Could be apocryphal, but maybe our listeners will know the answer to that question.
All right, well, I'm curious. These are the things that keep me up at night. Number two, California, California. Otherwise known as the drummer from Phantom Planet, the band that gave us the theme song for The OC, my number two is Jason Schwartzman in Rushmore. Every now and then an actor comes along and just blows you away, and I think his performance as Max in Rushmore was one of those. You can tell the guy is just a natural performer. An actor could train for years and not approach the ease that Schwartzman finds in every scene of that movie. Every line, every reaction rings absolutely true. And of course, I know genetics probably have something to do with it when your mom is Talia Shire and your cousin is Nicolas Cage, but to create one of the most memorable characters in recent film history in Max Fisher, you get on my list.
A great pick. And I will just say, having had the opportunity to sit down with Jason Schwartzman for 20 minutes, he's exactly how you would expect him to be. Just a funny, kind of goofy, just fun guy to hang around. He really was incredibly cool. So I'm glad to see he made your list. My number two, again, talk about conventional, but I really do like this performance a lot. It's Frank Sinatra, and he's great in The Manchurian Candidate, but also I think the best thing about Otto Preminger's 1955 film, The Man with the Golden Arm, is Sinatra's performance, where he plays a heroin addict with dreams of being a drummer in a big band. He got an Oscar nomination for it for Best Actor. Eleanor Parker as Zosh, his wife in this film, his wheelchair-bound wife, she may be the most annoying character in the history of cinema, and quite frankly, for me, drags the film down a little bit. But Sinatra's charisma makes you see why everybody in this movie keeps giving him second chances. Despite his stupidity and his vulnerability, you keep rooting for him. You want him to get the monkey off his back, the monkey of heroin, and also the monkey of his wife, and you want him to succeed. Again, despite the fact that he makes consistently awful choices, and I think Sinatra is a big reason why. And also, you have to give him some credit in these heroin scenes, the train spotting scene where we get to see him try to kick it cold turkey. He has to be locked in his room. Those scenes, whether they're cliched or not by this point, he delivers in them. I completely bought him as a heroin addict trying to kick the monkey cold turkey. So Frank Sinatra is my number two.
Well, it's also a nice tie-in with our Chicago theme. It's actually based on Nelson Algren's book set in Wicker Park here.
Yes.
I don't like him as much in that movie as much as I do in From Here to Eternity. I think actually that's his best role.
Well, and I did mention that earlier, that this was the Chicago tie-in. It's one we considered for our Overlook list, but it actually wasn't shot here in the city. We had to exclude it.
All right, my number one, I'm going back with you. It's The Country Girl and Bing Crosby. Bing really deserves to be on this list because he's one of the most commercially successful actors of all time. And as a kid, I was pretty much groomed on his movies. He's probably best known for White Christmas and the Road movies with Bob Hope, which I absolutely adore, and in which he really displays such ease and comfort. You just love the guy. But he really shines in this lesser-known film, Country Girl. He plays an actor who loses his son and begins to destroy his career in marriage by drinking. He gets one last shot in a new play, but his chances are crippled by his drinking and his relationship with his wife, played by Grace Kelly, who has her own set of problems. Based on the great Clifford Odets play, it's pretty melodramatic by today's standards, but really gripping, and Bing proves he can branch out.
Another one I look forward to checking out. I have not seen that film. Great pick. Nice to see Bing Crosby getting some love here on Film Spotting. My number one,
David Bowie in Labyrinth.
It is not David Bowie in Labyrinth. Sorry to disappoint you, Maddie. I remember Charlie Wade come to my father's hardware store once. I was just a little boy, and I heard stories about how he shot this in, how he shot that in. The man winked at me. I peed my pants. He winked at me. That, of course, would be Kris Kristofferson in two movies. This is where I'm cheating. Lone Star, the John Sayles film, as the Sheriff Charlie Wade. You hear that quote, you understand it when you see the flashback scenes with Charlie Wade. Chris Christopherson pulls off that kind of just absolute evil and selfishness and greed. He's really terrifying in an interesting way, I think, in Lone Star. But also, really, I'm singling him out for a movie we had a chance to talk about a little bit in conjunction with our review of The Assassination of Jesse James, and that's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the Sam Peckinpah film. Chris Christopherson has appeared in like 70 or 80 movies by this point, but I think he's always memorable because he has that natural presence. Part of it is that he's huge and that distinct voice, a lot like Tom Waits. But I love him in Lone Star and really in Pat Garrett in that film. Bob Dylan also may get some love from people because he appears in that film his first time as an actor, and I think his performance is really more of a curio than anything, but Christopherson brings this integrity and charm to Billy the Kid that absolutely makes you understand why people flock to him, something I thought was lacking in The Assassination of Jesse James. But he also brings some depth to Billy the Kid, an understanding of how the world is changing and that his time is really past. It's all there in a really interesting performance. Chris Christopherson, my number one.
I really liked your list this week.
Thank you. It's a love fest here on Film Spotting, Maddie, because I thought your list was inspired as well. Some stuff I need to check out. That's always a good sign of a good top five list.
All right. Well, those are our top five performances by musicians turned actors. Send your list if you want to throw any love to Lyle Lovett in the player or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463. And leave a voice message.
Opening wide this weekend, 30 Days of Night, a horror film, the comeback, the sports parody, Rendition, and Gone Baby Gone, which we mentioned earlier. On next week's show, we will have reviews of Rendition and Gone Baby Gone, and we'll also revive, not Ingmar Bergman, sadly, but our Ingmar Bergman marathon with 1957's The Seventh Seal.
Thanks to Alex and Angela on our message boards, Frank Huckle and the great Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Scotland Yard Gospel Choir for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
Instant ones that makes it not as good for you, because when you look at it, it looks like oats.
It does,
but it's what I think it is. It's like the process of doing it. It's like white rice versus brown rice. They strip it of the nutrition to make it like they
do that on purpose. They say, well, first we're going to strip it of its nutrition, and then we're going to put it in a little packet.
Because that's what the people want.
Have or hit at some point in some way, but we didn't know how, when, or you know. Or how and when again.
Can I give you something? I'm doing this like as this to be edited out.
Say it.
Okay. I was going to say maybe you should answer it, by, but you don't even have to mic me on this one.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm saying this. You could do that answer with, you could talk about it being a personal movie. That might be, because
that's where I was going to go. Okay. Was that we. Was that good?
I thought that was good. Okay. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, no, I was lost anyway. I was.
All right.
I needed a lighthouse.
Sorry about that.
I was just off the shore, but it was foggy, and you were a little like,
ooh. You should have been on him for that.
I think the microphone picked that one up.
It'll be there.
You'll probably get that. Oh, sorry.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciated your time. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Rock and roll.
Thank you. Sweet. Was I interrupting you too much?
No, I like it. Sometimes you just can't. Say the right
thing. Believe me, I know.
That's like weird. Like, and that's why I was like looking to you.